Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. Today for Spirit in Action, we welcome back Chuck Fager, a writer and activist with some 60 years of work. And we also welcome Emma Lapsansky-Werner, co-author of Tell It Slant, Chuck Fager, A Prophetic Life of Adventure and Writing on Religion, War and Justice, Love and Laughter. Chuck's journalism has been interwoven with his work with the civil rights movement, peace and justice actions, and as director of Quaker House, a place of peace in a military city. The 58-plus page bibliography of this book will give you an idea of the extent of his writings. Emma is Professor Emeritus from Haverford College, and this is only the latest in a long list of books by Emma. These are two gifted and fruitful authors, so we have an uncut version of this interview on northernspiritradio.org with an additional 14 minutes with them. And they join us today from Pennsylvania and from North Carolina via Zoom. Chuck, it's great to have you back again for Spirit in Action.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to be here.
And Emma, this is your first time here. I'm really happy to have you.
I'm happy to be here. It's always good to be in the company of people who are trying to figure out how to get us our world cleaned up. Our world does need cleaning.
A lot of cleaning. And I think it gives reasons for some of us to keep working on long after we're supposed to be retired.
Tell me about it. I retired in 2010.
Yeah? How retired are you?
Not at all.
And Chuck, you've been going on, and I thought, you know, maybe 5 years ago or something, you were going to finish your last book, but you had this one and this one and this one. How many are yet on the horizon?
I really don't know. There are lots of ideas, but I am not actively at work on any book. We've had a very busy time in this country as citizens. Maybe those gears are about to shift, or maybe not, but I've found myself thinking, I'd like to look inward some and maybe do some more writing that maybe is not just about stuff going on outside. That's a thought and an impulse. It's not definitely a plan yet.
Even though so much of your writing has been activist related, you've also had this strong slant, which I would call inner. Humor is an inner thing, and theology has been a big part of what Chuck Fager has written about. So do you think that you've ever not been inner focused?
Well, that's astute. Back in the day, when I was coming up, the Myers-Briggs test was a big thing. Lots of people did. It told you whether you were an extrovert or an introvert and all of that stuff. And I took it, and I came out super introverted. One could look at me or my history and say, well, if you're so damn introverted, how come you wrote all these books and were doing all this activism? But, well, two things can be true.
Like Parker Palmer's book, The Promise of Paradox. It's totally true.
Chuck and I are in some ways a pair of paradoxi. I'd like to read you a little piece from the book, if that's okay.
Sure. Go ahead, Emma.
This is not at the beginning. It's in the middle. In 2014, Charles Chuck Fager published a sketch of the first 70 years of his long, dedicated, and sinuous life. By that time, I had already decided that Chuck was among the most interesting Quakers alive in the 21st century. Journalist, essayist, novelist, resolute pursuer of history, independent publisher, provocateur, activist, whistleblower, teacher, father, friend with a capital and small f, community organizer, theological seeker, and self-defined finder, in the 17th century meaning of those words. And all of this has arisen from a foundation of his staunch commitment to nonviolence, to social justice, to activism, and to what he calls truth-telling, which is why this book has that title. During the 3 decades I've known Chuck, I've watched casually but admiringly from the sidelines, as he has, to borrow Mary Catherine Bateson's imagery, composed a life. I've sprinkled Chuck's writings liberally through my classroom teaching at Haverford College, and have enjoyed watching his perspectives on real and imaginary Quakers stretch my students' minds. Chuck and I are in some ways soulmates, children of a similar era, born under the mushroom clouds of World War II, raised in families shaped by a deep connection to American military tradition. My father's return from World War I, Distinguished Service Cross and French Croix de Guerre proudly on his breast, He arrived just 2 months before the birth of Chuck's father, who was born that year and who earned, in World War II, several distinguished flying medals. Coming of age in the civil rights Vietnam era, Chuck and I grew up in families steeped in traditional Christian religions, and both Chuck and I, religious mavericks, found our way as young adults to the contra-traditional Christianity of the Religious Society of Friends, with its powerful undercurrent of opposition to both war and formalized authority. And each of us has kept our Christianity alive amid liberal Quakers ever since.
Wow, that's a great summary. That's the thing I should have said at the beginning of this interview, Emma. Again, the book is called Tell It Slant, Chuck Fager, A Prophetic Life of Adventure and Writing on Religion, War, and Justice, Love, and Laughter by Emma Lapsansky-Warner and Chuck Fager. To get started on this, I mean, the politics, the activism, civil rights, or working at Quaker House in Fayetteville, North Carolina, right by Fort Bragg, those are important parts. But I would like to start with an understanding of the underpinning that motivates this book. 510 pages of the main part of the book, plus 58 pages of bibliography. Chuck, I have a confession to make. I did not finish reading all of the bibliography. Everything else I did.
Well, it's not complete, so we'll get another chance when I get a chance.
Okay.
There's a good bit of work which I wasn't able to run down in the course of trying to get this book finished. Some people ask me, how come it's 500 and all those pages? I said, well, that's because I left out 500 more, at least. After all, I'll be 82 in a few weeks. And I have the good or bad fortune to have been born in what they call interesting times. That's the thing about being an introvert and then producing all these books and having done various activist stuff.
Chuck, you are what my husband calls what I am, and that is a gregarious introvert.
Well, maybe. I'm very much a homebody nowadays. Don't go out much. I had a stroke about 5 years ago, which was not a bad, terrible bad stroke, but it took part of my vision, and it made it impossible for me to drive anymore after 60 years. And, you know, you feel disfranchised after that. I was a driver for 60 years. And isn't that in the Constitution?
Pretty much.
That and guns are in the Constitution.
Well, I had a gun when I was a teenager, but I haven't had a gun since then. But I don't miss that one. And yet, when I had to face the fact that I wasn't going to drive anymore, well, I get out, people take me places. But I settled in at home. When I retired in 2012, my goal was to age in place. Managed to find a little house in Durham. The housing market was way, way at the bottom still. So I was able to buy it with my accumulated savings, and I've succeeded in aging in place here for going on 12 years, and I hope to keep doing that until they haul me out in a gurney with a sheet over my face.
Let's determine one thing. All of the books that you've written, all the publications you've written, the hundreds of this combined ways you've tried to impact the world through your words, they made you rich, right?
That's a good answer.
Yeah. Emma has, occasionally, she has writer's weekends, and she invited me to a couple of them. And the last couple of them, I gave a talk about trying to summarize and outline my successful career as a writer to these interested folks. And I think I have had a successful career as a writer, as a published writer, but the shape of it is pretty simple. I've had a succession of day jobs to support my underlying and inescapable urge to write, because one, like most published writers, not wannabe writers who have manuscripts in the drawer someplace, but people who've actually gotten stuff in print, like most of them, most of us, I've had day jobs. I may have made a little bit of money from writing, but not much, not enough to support myself or to support my family. I have four kids that are all grown now. So I've had a succession of day jobs, and that's what most published writers do. And why I say I'm a success is that much of my writing has been motivated by part of the inwardness. The inwardness is built around the question of what the heck is this stuff called Quakerism, and how do I understand that, and how do I actually more or less be one? A very wise Quaker, colleague, friend of mine, John Calvi, he said he learned from an old Quaker in his early days attending meeting, who said to him, you think it's easy to be a Quaker? Just come in and sit down and shut up. That part is relatively easy. But actually, it takes a long time to be a Quaker. Decades. And it looks different as you go along. And I've found that to be true. So I'm still sort of learning. So it's taking a long time. But I'm interested in that. And I ended up wanting to write about that. But you know what? The world doesn't care about Quaker. If I had been smart from a business perspective, I would have gone back to my childhood Catholicism. There's lots of Catholic publishers and newspapers and magazines, you know, that can pay money. Or maybe I would have converted it to Judaism because, you know, Jews, they write books about Jewishness and its fortunes and misfortunes all the time. But that didn't happen. I happen to be a Quaker, interested in Quakers, and I just keep writing about Quakers. I have been successful in that I've been able to write about the things that I was really interested in. That's what made my writing career successful from my personal perspective. The fact that I had to have day jobs, the whole succession of them, which are described in the book, Tell It Slant. That's just happenstance, or are they, I mean, they're related in various ways to sort of the inward work. But let me give you an example here. I have a book called Eating Dr. King's Dinner. It's a memoir about my time in this, actively in the civil rights movement, mostly in Selma, Alabama, and around 1965. Well, there's been lots of adventures. I was in jail with Dr. King, marched, and you know, all the sort of excitements, but that's not the point I want to mention this. If you look at the book closely, I'm pretty candid about the fact that kind of the underlying theme of that memoir is there any order, meaning, or sense in this part of my life? Or was it just a series of weird coincidences? I say that, or I put the question that way, because if I had tried to turn that memoir into a novel and send it to a publisher and say, here's a story about this, I don't think any respectable editor would have been willing to publish it because they would have sent me back feedback and said, well, maybe there's some interesting stuff in here, but the plot is not credible. There's too many silly, unlikely coincidences. Readers won't put up with that. It's not good fiction. And I would have agreed with that criticism. But unfortunately, that stuff all happened. I wound up in the civil rights movement. I wound up in jail with Dr. King overnight through a series of coincidences, which, is there an order to them? Is my life being pushed in a direction? Or is it just, you know, am I just bumbling along? And that's sort of the underlying, do I have an answer for that? No, I have a good story in the book of what happened. But, you know, it's a literary expression of a wrestling with that question. And really, that question wasn't answered in that book or in any of the others, including this one, Tell It Slant. But it's there as well.
We should define something first, because actually I came away from reading the 510 pages of the main part of the book, and I still don't really think I know what it means to say Tell It Slant. You better say that.
Sure. It's from a poem by one of my favorite poets, Emily Dickinson. And it's short. I'm going to read it in a minute, but I have to point out that Emily Dickinson was even more reclusive than I've become. And she wrote all these poems, and almost none of them was published in her lifetime, maybe half a dozen. And she wrote them on little pieces of paper, and some of them she sort of sewed together into little booklets. So she left heaps of these around when she died. She didn't give them titles. And so when her editors, when they got together and tried to make sense of this, they gave them numbers. And so the title of my book, or this book, Emma's in my book about my life, Tell It Slant, is from Emily Dickinson's poem number 1263. Sort of kind of just rolls off the tongue. 1263. And here it is. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies, too bright for our infirm delight. The truth's superb surprise. As lightning to the children eased with explanation kind, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind. That's it. I thought, you know what? I like that. It says something. I don't know exactly what. Tell all the truth, but tell a slant. Now, there's a famous British playwright whose name is escaping me at the moment who said it another way. He said, if you're going to tell people the truth, you better make them laugh or they're going to kill you. I haven't actually faced people with guns coming after me because of something I wrote. Not yet, anyway. But it has upset a few apple carts and, you know, left some folks with some egg on their face. So that's the poem. That's where the title comes from.
Another thing that we need to tell about the book right away is what role you, Chuck, and what role you, Emma, have in making this book. Because you're listed as co-authors. There's a point at the book in which you say, okay, Emma's bowing out here, but Chuck's taking over. This is, you know, the last fourth of the book or something. So what kind of collaboration was this? And mainly what I want to ask you, is how difficult was it to work with Chuck?
I'm going to read you an answer, and I'm going to give you a couple of things. Chuck and I are soulmates in a lot of ways. Both of us, self-identifying as introverts, I'm reading from page 23, learned very early in life to love and to draw comfort from words, our own words and the words of others, including the words of Emily Dickinson, who was one of my mother's favorites. And one of the things that she wrote was, "I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Well, there's two of us. We're a pair." And in some ways, that Emily Dickinson poem underpins the Tell It Slant that is on the front cover. Chuck and I share a lascivious appetite for European classical music. We liked words, our own words, and the words of others. Each of us feels safe if there's a library nearby. I've often jestingly described Chuck as a man who writes and self-publishes an average of 5,000 words a day. He says I'm exaggerating, but I think my flippant estimate is not far off. And I've written more than a few words myself, but ever the pragmatist, Chuck went beyond mere writing to establish his own publishing enterprise and a network of websites to better deliver his ideas to the eyes of his readers. So I plumbed those websites, and every now and then I would write to Chuck and say, I don't understand completely what happened on, let's say, July 1st, 1982. And what I'd get back is maybe 30 pages of what happened. I would distill those down into something that linked the narrative together. So that basically I think of myself as a shell gatherer on the beach, figuring out how to pull the string through to link those shells together to have them be one long trail of shells. That was basically my job. Because I happen to love words, and I'm the child of mother and grandmother who loved words, my grandfather used to make his children stand on an orange crate and have elocution lessons once a week because he felt that public speaking was important. My mother didn't quite go that far, but she was close. So I love words, and Chuck has a whole lot of them. And it felt as if my job was to sequentialize them so that a consumer could nibble on them in bite-sized pieces and follow the life of a contemplative man. Does that get an answer to your question?
It does. Practically speaking, again, the book is written with a lot of insertion of writings of Chuck's. I think the things that he wrote actually have a line, a vertical line next to them on the left-hand side of the page. And then there's words that you or you and Chuck have written around the shells that you've linked together. I think that's how it goes.
That's exactly how it was put together. I would call and I would say, I don't understand this. And Chuck would explain this. Sometimes the explaining of this with the line down the side, sometimes it was lifted out of something he'd published before. But just as often, it was an extended answer to a short question.
My first interview with you, Chuck, was back in January of 2006, just 6 months after I started Norton Spirit Radio and started doing both Spirit in Action, Song of the Soul. So you were early on, and that's because I've been a follower of yours, inspired by yours, since the 1980s. I was an early, I think, subscriber to A Friendly Letter, a Respondent Spark, Quaker Bible Study book that you wrote, all of these things. I read them back in the 80s and 90s, and so I've been a fan and impressed by you. You, like me, grew up Catholic, so I have a very important question for you. So, bless you, Charles, for you have sinned. When was your last confession? Or is this book it?
Not really, because I've left that kind of thing behind. My last confession would probably have been in 1958, 59, because, yes, I was raised Catholic. My mother was very devout. My father was more removed from that. But nonetheless, I was taken to Mass. Went to catechism classes. I was sent to catechism classes. My mother taught me catechism classes and taught me stuff to, you know, memorize prayers and answers to catechism questions. And then in the middle of my junior year in high school, I was sent to a Catholic school, Catholic military school in Western Kansas. I was born in Kansas. My family settled in Kansas. That was the year when I discovered that I didn't believe all that stuff. My grades were good at this Catholic military school. I was on the drill team, took the SAT and got very good scores and yada, 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 yada. But then I got kicked out. And it was not for misbehavior. It was for heresy. because I had come to find out that I didn't believe all this stuff and talked about it with some of my fellow students. And the people who ran the school found that they could put up with a few non-Catholics. There were a handful of non-Catholics at the school. But somebody who was going around saying, this Trinity stuff is a lot of baloney and stuff like that. That was a bridge too far. During the middle of the year, I was thinking I was going to keep going to that school and finish up and graduate. And so I bought a school ring. And then that summer, got the letter from the head of the school saying I couldn't come back. And the letter was pretty candid. They didn't accuse me of misbehavior. They said he doesn't believe it. And his presence and words are, this is a rough paraphrase, are undermining faith of our students. And we can't have that. About that time, I got a little package. I didn't get mail much in those days. And I opened the little package and there was that school ring. And I thought, boy, that was $25 wasted. And $25 was a lot of money that year. But then I looked at it and turned it over in my hand and thought, you know what? This ring has a very different meaning than it did when I ordered it, but it is still very significant. And I put it on my hand and there it is, 60 some years later. Wedding rings come and go. This ring, which now represents my departure and self-emancipation from a Catholic childhood, remained. Of course, Catholicism left marks on me. There are things about it which I actually appreciate from outside, but I've never really seriously been tempted to go back to that. Of course, I'm looking at my bookshelf. Yeah, I wrote a book about this, another memoir. It's called Meetings, just one word, Meetings. And in that book, I describe this pilgrimage up to the first 10 years of my involvement with Friends. And Meetings has many words, it has many meanings in the title, one of the Quaker meetings, but another encounters with really interesting and impressive people, most of them alive, some of them not, who were Quakers. And I think of them as my elders. We didn't have formal elders in our meetings when I was coming up, but I had elders, people who guided me and sometimes, you know, told me to sit down and shut up without actually saying that, and learned a great deal from them and paid tribute to them in this memoir Meetings. And that process really has gone on because you don't outgrow the need and the value of good eldering. Even though I'm a liberal Quaker who doesn't want to have formal official elders looking over us from elevated facing benches in meetings. But nonetheless, that process is a real one and has been part of my spiritual life.
Folks, we're going to get a lot more detail about the book, Tell It Slant, co-written by Emma Lipsansky-Warner and Chuck Fager, subtitled Chuck Fager, A Prophetic Life of Adventure and Writing on Religion, War, and Justice, Love, and Laughter, in a moment. But first, I wanted to remind you, our website is northernspiritradio.org. You can see all of the episodes from 2005 on, that's 19 and a half years, on northernspiritradio.org. Comment on, listen to my previous, I think it's three interviews with Chuck, the first one back in January of 2006. Please come comment. I love two-way communication. I feel like my voice is just fine, but what really makes it valuable is when we sing together. So I really hope that you'll give us feedback. You can also donate, support us. You can look up the 35-plus stations nationwide that carry our program nationwide. That's in addition to all the places where we're podcast, which is probably 15, 20 of them across there. Or you can just listen via our website. So please do that. Support those local community radio stations. Please support alternative media. I want to ask Chuck a few things about that. But the thing I really want to talk to you both about, Emma and Chuck, is activism. Chuck, you started out by talking about how you're raised Catholic. You went to a military school, a Catholic military school, and got kicked out for atheism. But as I think I've heard you say a number of times, something to the effect of that the atheists had the best arguments, but you could never reconcile yourself to that because you could feel there was something more. But activism, your first big book was Selma, 1965, not your first publication at all, but your first big book was Selma, 1965. Activism had a big part in your life. And Emma, I hear very clearly that making this a better world was fundamental for you. So how did you get to activism, both of you? And you should fight over who goes first.
I was just going to say, and who goes first?
Emma.
I can be quick and tidy because I've just now put my family's 5,000 documents into the archives at Haverford so that you can see where I come from. The earliest activist I know of is a man named Denard Hughes, whose ancestors were on the eastern shore of Maryland in the 1770s. Most of them were free, but some of them were not. Denard Hughes in 1851 said, "I got to get out of here. I'm not going to be a slave." He was a slave. And he was part of the Dover Eight, who were covered in the newspaper in 1851. So he's the earliest one I know of. But there's a parade of them after that. There's the great aunt who is noted in the Congressional Record in 1937. She's standing in front of Congress arguing for equal schooling for hearing impaired children. There's my grandmother who closed the door in a doctor's face because he called her Jeanette instead of Mrs. Jenkins. That was 1910. She said, "We don't need medical care if you can't call me Mrs. Jenkins." She was a suffragette. When she got to the place where she could vote, her husband said to her, "Oh, go vote, Jeannie, go vote. I'll take care of the kids in the house. You get out there and vote." I am aware of my father who provided medical care for people who couldn't pay him and who served as the leader in the NAACP in Washington, D.C. I have an uncle who was an NAACP and UN journalist in the 1940s. I have an aunt who went to Haiti in the 1940s to teach people to read so that they could be free. She then went from there to India because Gandhi was where she needed to be. I come at this from a long line of people who said, "You know, I got to go do what I got to go do." So in 1966, I left college, went to Mississippi to work in the civil rights movement. That's another story for another day, and you've probably heard way more about my story than you need to. But I did then marry in 1966 another hellraiser who has the honor of being on a poster stuck up there in Jackson, Mississippi, that said, "Senator Eastland hates this guy. You should too."
High praise.
Exactly, exactly. His children are very fond of that and very proud of it. I have three justice warrior children. One of them runs a clinic for HIV positive people and has a grant to make sure that they get good medical care and that the interns who interview them ask the right questions to get all the information they need. I have one who is an organizer for the international group Save the Children. You know, this is in the genes, and I like my genes.
And Chuck, again, you were in a military school, a Catholic family, be proud of your service. And you worked for some 12 years at Quaker House, serving military people, helping them out, supporting the soldiers and opposing the war, which I think is a wise thing to say and do. So how did you go from being, let's say, enthusiastic about being in military school to being this aberrant form of religion, which not universally, but very widely is seen as pacifist?
Right. Well, my genealogy or heritage could hardly be more different from Emma's in this respect. My family, both sides, were from a little farm village in southeastern Kansas. If they were active in anything outside of the big Catholic Church, I don't know about it. We didn't talk about politics over the dinner table at our house. I don't recall my parents telling us that they had voted. Many military people, career people, didn't. They thought it was not their role. But there was the idea of, I was surrounded by propaganda, particularly from World War II, where my father was a bomber pilot over Europe and survived and didn't talk about it. And the idea of serving your country or presumably the better part of mankind, people kind, and taking risks in doing that, it was just in the air. And so I wound up in college and joined ROTC. There's a picture in the book of me in my ROTC uniform. I look pretty spiffy as a sophomore. But I wound up quitting it, not because I had become a pacifist, but believe it or not, I had learned by growing up in the setting between World War II and the Vietnam War that the military without a big war is very boring as a place to live. I had an ROTC instructor when I was at college, Air Force guy. He'd been a pilot, and he was a bit younger than my father. He had joined the Air Force in the middle of World War II, and they sent him to pilot training, and they were going to send him to the Pacific. And he actually ended up starting out heading for the Western Pacific, and before the assault on Japan was going to take place.
Then they dropped the atomic bombs on Japan. Japan surrendered, and the war was over. He wound up staying in the Air Force, going to college, getting degrees in history and stuff, and winding up. But he still was still a pilot or on pilot status. And he took me under his wing, and he saw me as his gift to the Air Force. However, my own perspective on the world and on the military changed. I'm afraid I looked at this fellow and I saw somebody who had been trained to be, let's say, a highly skilled, long distance over the road truck driver, completed his training, did well, and was put in a big truck and taken out onto a huge, let's say, Amazon distribution center parking lot and told to drive that truck around in circles for 20 years. In fact, that's what my father did after World War II. He wound up flying bombers around in circles on the periphery of the Soviet Union. I think that's what he was doing. It was all secret, but he was gone for a long time, periods of time. And that was boring. Maybe we were saving civilization and stopping the communists and all that sort of stuff. It was boring. Boring to me. I thought of doing it for 20 years to get a pension. Just by the time I was into my senior year in college, it was driving me nuts.
You think your father found it boring?
I don't. He said that was his escape from the farm, the drudgery of farm work in rural Kansas. He was willing to risk his life in combat for it because he loved to fly. As a matter of fact, there's an epiphany in my book, one of my books about this, where this officer I described, who took me under his wing, took me up in a training jet flight from an airbase near Denver because he saw that my interest was flagging. And he flew me around his training jet and it was through gee whiz, you know. And I was sitting behind him in the cockpit and I had earphones on. And he came on the line and he said, you know, Chuck, when I'm up here flying, we were flying down from Denver. We flew over the Air Force Academy and turned around back, came back. So when I'm up here flying, I can't think of anything I'd rather be doing than doing this. That was like somebody whacking me upside the head with a 2x4 because I thought to myself, I did not speak. I thought, gee, I can think of half a dozen things I'd rather be doing than this. And a lot of them centered around, guess what? Books. I wasn't writing books then, but reading them. And you know, and pretty soon I was out of ROTC, not because I had turned against the airport or military. All that peace stuff came later. Is that I was not going to spend my life flying around in circles, being bored out of my tree. Now, who knew that Vietnam was around the corner where lots of pilots were going to get in trouble? I didn't.
Oh, maybe if you had known Vietnam was coming, maybe you would have stayed in just for the excitement.
You know what? I would have ended up in trouble because there was so much lie. The war was based on lies. And when speculating, you don't get to live your life over again. When I encountered the lies, what was I going to do? I wasn't going to keep quiet about them. Well, maybe I would for a while, but then I wasn't going to be able to. And I was going to have to do something, speak up. And that's trouble. That is trouble. Hey, I got in enough trouble doing that when I came to Quakerism. Sooner or later, I discovered there was all kinds of problems in Quakerdom and people were shoving them under the rug. And I said, you know, that's not right because we need to solve our issues just like anybody else or any other institution. But who's doing that? At least in print, really nobody. So I started doing it. And there were people whose apple carts were upset. There were people whose sacred cows were turned into hamburger, and some of them didn't like it. Still don't. But you know what? You said you were a subscriber to the print version of A Friendly Letter that started in 1981, went to 1993. It exposed lots of unpleasant and sometimes even corrupt stuff going on in Quakerdom. We're a small group, but we're equally human with most any other churches, and we got our share of problems and corruptions.
I was in debate when I was in 3 years of high school and 2 years of college, but I stopped doing it because I found out it killed my soul in some way, because you could give me any topic and I would argue for it and tell the other person they were wrong. And I knew that I was good at it and it was a bad thing for me. So I had to back off from that. I know you've been accused, Chuck, of being a gadfly. There's various words. One of them, a sentence that you attributed to a really good friend of yours, or no, it was your brother. One phrase that your brother, evidently loving you, but all the time said all the things about that were negative from his point of view. Maybe you can rattle off the sentence.
Gee, somehow it escapes my memory, but... But yeah, but I don't deny it. If you were to go back and look over 133 issues of the print edition of A Friendly Letter over 12 years, you would find me following a certain kind of discipline wherein I was careful to space out the sort of expose stories with articles that were about things that I liked. And there were more articles about stuff I liked than stuff I criticized and challenged and called out. Now, in the course of time, this is how it works in the media world. Guess which ones get remembered most often? And guess which ones get copied and recopied and passed around to people I don't know, and I hear about them second and third and fourth hand? They're the sensational critical ones. Well, I stand by them. I never had to apologize or retract a critical story, but they were a minority of the work that I did through that meeting. That was intentional both because, as a matter of pacing, yes, it's not good to be talking trash all the time. And on the other hand, there was lots that I liked about Quaker. That's why I stayed, you know, and I wanted to find it. Plus, in every issue, even the most critical ones, I had jokes. I had humor. That was, in my judgment, personal, religious, as well as professional. That's a necessity. It's not dessert. It's sort of like air and water. It's a necessity. Life is tough enough, even among Quakers. We got to lighten it up if we can. And one of my best-selling Quaker books, best-selling, it didn't make me rich, was called Quakers Are Funny.
And the sequel, Quakers Are Hilarious, didn't sell as well?
Didn't sell as well, right.
You're not joking about that, are you?
Nope. I am joking when I say liberal Quakers don't believe in hell, and that's because we have committees.
You know the definition of a committee. It's a group of people who take hours to produce minutes.
I love it. I was looking, thumbing through the book, tried to find the interview with Chuck's brother, and I can't put my hands on it. I promise you an index sometime soon, Chuck. We keep talking about it.
Indexes are a lot of work, and they cost money. And I have to sell a good many more copies of Till and Slant before I break even on it, even though it's much more possible to get into that sort of publishing now than it was before.
Again, we're talking with Chuck Fager and Emma Lepsansky Warner, co-authors of the book Tell It Slant, about the life and writings of Chuck Fager, subtitled A Prophetic Life of Adventure and Writing on Religion, War, and Justice, Love, and Laughter. Chuck, this isn't unusual because you have a volume of words, which I consider some of the best words that I've read, but you didn't really answer my question about how you got to a pacifist from ROTC. I understand how you left ROTC, and I think it's via Selma that you kind of got to in this direction. So how did you go from being rah-rah ROTC to being a lifelong pacifist and the director of Quaker House in Fayetteville right next to Fort Bragg?
Okay, fair question. And unfortunately, there was a lot of stuff that came together, but when I wound up getting interested in the civil rights movement, mainly because of the March on Washington, which I did not go to, I was working at that summer of 1963 on the campus of Colorado State University, where I was a student. And I had acquaintances who saw some of the news articles about the buildup to the March on Washington. And I don't know, several people and maybe stuff I read said, this march will never happen without blood running in the streets. The implication was either black people were inherently violent and a large number of them had to devolve into violence, or if they gathered, and even if they were peaceful, the Klan would appear and there would be a massacre. I found myself saying, no, they'll be able to do it. They'll be able to, besides, there'll be lots of cops there as well. And of course, I didn't go, but I followed it and I was really sort of thrilled by it. Then I got sort of interested in stuff. I ended up becoming part of, with the editor of the campus paper, forming a self-appointed committee to invite some outside speakers dealing with civil rights. We actually had Governor George Wallace from Alabama and James Meredith, who had integrated the University of Mississippi. And these stories and addresses were intentionally interesting to me. One thing led to another, and I wound up getting a graduate fellowship to attend Atlanta University. I had asked James Meredith when he came to speak, I said, this is really interesting. I want to know more about it. What's the best black graduate school? And he said, Atlanta University. So I wrote to him and they had some fellowships and I applied for one. I got one. I got down there, signed up to get a master's degree in English. And they put me in classes studying 18th century British novels. Daniel Defoe, you know, and I got a couple of those. I took them back to a little apartment, tried to read them, and I couldn't read them. I couldn't force myself to pay attention to them. Not that they were bad, but I just couldn't do it. And I looked in the mirror, and why not? I said, well, the answer is obvious, Turkey. You didn't come here to study 18th century British novels. You came here because of the struggle, the civil rights movement. Well, what am I going to do about that? Anyway, I only lasted at Atlanta University about 2 days, and I went and dropped out. I ended up sitting down and wrote a letter to Dr. King's organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Pay a lot if I had money to get a copy of that letter, because it basically said, this is a paraphrase, well, here I am, just what you need, another clueless white kid from the North. I didn't have any of the characteristics of the white folks who are known to history as joining the civil rights movement. My parents were not left-wingers. I was not a red diaper baby. I was not active in all that stuff in college, except with the stuff about the March on Washington. I didn't have the background. I didn't have contacts. Didn't know anybody. I wasn't rich with a trust fund to make donations and stuff. But by God, the office manager at Dr. King's organization, Randolph Blackwell, read it, and he wrote back to me and said, I said, I'm a writer. I'd done some writing at school, and I was going to be a writer, but I wasn't really much of a writer yet. And they fell for it. They hired me to be a subsistence worker for the grand sum of $25 a week. So anyway, I wound up in Selma as part of that movement. And I was barely able to walk and chew gum as far as the needs of the movement was concerned. But it was very intense, and I was learning stuff very rapidly. And then I began to notice something. That year, 1965, and this was in the winter and the spring, that was when Lyndon Johnson escalated the military operations in Vietnam into a major war. And we had the military draft then. When I finished college and I dropped out of Atlanta University, now I'm live bait for the draft. The war arrives. Well, my perspective on things was challenged by listening to Dr. King and paying attention and doing some studying about nonviolence, particularly began to pick up some stuff about the Civil War. I didn't become a scholar of it, but I mean, Selma, Alabama, one of the last battles of the Civil War was fought there. The debris was all around, and the reality, the impact of the Civil War was still very much alive. So we got into this war. I was raised in the Cold War. My father was a bomber pilot flying around helping save civilization from the commies. I took that for granted. But now I began to wonder, wait a minute, what is this war about? Is this some noble fight like stopping Japan and Nazi Germany? What's the deal? And I started looking into that. And I discovered it wasn't really hard, if you actually looked, that it was all based on lies. The Tonkin Gulf incident was a lie and all sorts of stuff. The generals were lying. The government we were supporting there were rotten and corrupt and oppressive and on and on and on. And I just found myself thinking, am I going to go pick up guns and shoot people for this? Wait a minute. But what am I going to do? And I said to a colleague, I told this to a colleague, what am I going to do? And they said, hey, well, hey, you can write to Philadelphia and get some paperwork and you could apply to be a conscientious objector. A what? I didn't know what that was. Well, there was this organization in Philadelphia then called the Central Committee for Conscientious Objectors, and they had a handbook. If I had to put 10 books on a shelf that shaped my life, their handbook, which cost 50 cents in those days, would be on that list because I got it. I read through it, and it wasn't necessarily, it didn't make an effort to try to persuade me into pacifism. It said, if you're because of religious training or whatever your way you got here, you have doubts about the military, here's what you might be able to do. And they had cases and all of that stuff. And I read all this stuff and I thought, I think I'm there. I don't think I can do this. I was scared when in physical danger, but I had been in physical danger during the civil rights movement. So I wasn't a total coward. If there were risks to be taken for freedom and truth, justice in the American way and peace, well, I'd be willing to consider them anyway. But this business of making war, it just didn't. And for me, the Civil War, I was beginning to see, was an enormous tragedy, which somehow we should have avoided it, but we didn't. Most other countries that got rid of slavery managed to do it without civil wars. Anyway, I read the paperwork, thought about it. Yeah. So I finally sat down and I wrote out a form, sent it in. You had to have a reference. I gave Dr. King as a reference. He sent me a copy of a letter. It was a very brief letter. All he had to attest to was his belief that I was sincere. And it was relatively brief. I'm pretty sure his secretary wrote it, signed it. And I can imagine my draft board, which was in Cheyenne, Wyoming, opening that letter and passing it around, draft boards are made up of local residents, probably veterans, probably World War II veterans, sitting around a table. And I can, something like this happened, but I don't know exactly how it did. But passing my file around and looking at that letter and, hey, are you thinking what I'm thinking? Well, what are you thinking? Do we need Dr. King coming to the federal courtroom a few blocks away from here, talking in there about this punk and giving us bad publicity? No, I don't think so. Yeah, let's get rid of it. Well, that doesn't mean killing me. It means they approved my CO record. I mean, I didn't conceal the fact that I'd been in ROTC and had a military background. So there it was. There I was. And then the other coincidence, which I wouldn't be able to sell in a novel. About this time, in Selma, Alabama, one of the least Quaker populated states in the country, Quakerism came knocking at my door. And I'll skip the rest of that.
But people can find out about it if they read the book, Tell It Slant, co-written by Emma Lapsansky Warner and Chuck Fager. It's about Chuck Fager's life. I think I would refer to it as a semi-autobiography, a prophetic life of adventure and writing on religion, war, and justice, love, and laughter. There's so much in this book, folks, 510 pages plus the nearly 60 pages of bibliography. It's rich. And as the subtitle says, Prophetic Life of Adventure and Writing on Religion, War, Justice, Love, and Laughter. In so many ways, Chuck Fager, he goes where many people fear to tread. He organized the first major Quaker Bible conference amongst liberal Quakers, which is to say those who are most likely to not think of themselves as theological. This is a person who goes to a military academy and starts preaching atheism, or at least deep questioning, in a Catholic school. He has never feared to tread. And the thing we haven't talked about at all, or barely at all, is Chuck's time at Quaker House, Fayetteville, North Carolina, right next to Fort Bragg, a resource to help soldiers, particularly soldiers, I think, get out of the military. Is that too easy of a description? It's maybe not quite fair.
I only have to qualify it in this respect. We did not recruit people. We did not encourage people to leave the military. They called us. We didn't go to them. That was against our principles. It's also against the law to urge people to leave their military duty. What we did was give them good information about options that they would have and help them clarify their conscientious commitments about it. The one should that I would present them with would be something like this. That, look, you're going to be in the military for however long you are. But you know what? You're going to have your conscience as long as you're conscious. And the decisions you make have to be yours about staying in the military or not. But what I would urge you to do is clarify your conscience, your conscientious commitments about this, and follow your conscience. Follow your conscience. There were people who came in and they thought about it and their conscience told them to go back in the military. Okay, that's fine. So we didn't have, hey, with the Iraq War and Afghanistan wars were the ones that came upon us while I was at Quaker House after 9/11, 2001. And we didn't have to go looking for people. There were plenty of people in the military who were not happy about this, even though we didn't have a draft then anymore. So they had all voluntarily enlisted, but mostly they were young men. And most of the young men who voluntarily enlisted were people who were from places that had been badly treated by the American economy. People from coming out of poverty, lots of white kids, as well as lots of people of color. The poverty draft, not an official draft, but people that had lots of them. The best they could hope for was maybe sweeping floors at Walmart.
Actually, I had the experience. I used to play pickup basketball here. I'm talking about 20 years ago. There's a young black man who I played with and became friends. And he talked about the fact that, he's going to go in the military. That's his economic opportunity. One of the things that Quaker House did, the graphic novel that you created, Sergeant Abe, The Honest Recruiter. So even though you didn't try and recruit people to get out of the military, you did have people try and think seriously what it's going to involve before they went in.
Yes, and Sergeant Abe, our cartoon character, was put on a reproduction of the enlistment documents, because the enlistment documents were quite deceptive. a big sheet of paper, two sides. On the front, the recruiter would say, you sign up and we're going to give you a bonus and we're going to send you to this training that you can, in some skills that you can use when you get out, and yada, 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 yada. Here we are. Great. Sent. Fine. Okay. Sign here. Well, there's the other side, which you didn't really have to fill out. Lots of small print. And if you looked closely at the small print, there is a place in the small print that said, we don't have to keep any of the promises that we made on the other side. We don't even have to let you out when your enlistment is up. You sign in and you really get sworn into the military. We can keep you for as long as the war on terror goes on. And then afterwards, as long as the president says there's still some sort of emergency. Recruiters didn't talk about that. And if you only remembered one side of the enlistment form, you saw promises. And, you know, you want to be in a band? Oh, we got lots of bands. You want to play? You play basketball? We got basketball teams. We got basketball leagues. Now, those things were true, but only a very small number ever got into those things. And I had a sister who did a tour in the Air Force. She told me that when she got off the bus at Lackland Air Force Base in Texas for basic training, she was standing with some other new recruits. I think they were still in civilian clothes by the bus. And a group of recruits who had been there for a couple of weeks came marching by in their uniform. And they had these, they call them cadence calls that they would call out as they were marching. When they got nearby, they started chanting. They said, new bird, don't be blue. My recruiter screwed me too. But then it was too late for them.
Let's end with a little bit of something like levity here. One point in the book, it's page 440 in Tell It Slant. You talk about being asked by a kid if you were Santa Claus. I just want to let you know that I am at least as much Santa Claus as you are, Chuck. Back, I guess it was about 6-7 years ago, I got a job doing a Santa thing. Took my granddaughter, who was at the time 6, as my elf. And when we're driving home, 9 o'clock at night, she's in the back seat of a car driving 30 miles. I hear from the back, she says, you know, Grandpa, you really are pretty much like Santa. So your story in the book made me think that we're in a competition there. Maybe the Santa Smackdown competition. And I wanted to tell you my favorite one-liner humor, and I wanted you to repost with one of yours. Did you hear, Chuck, about the dyslexic devil worshiper who screwed up and sold his soul to Santa? Dave, you got to come back.
Well, I haven't heard that one. I have heard about the dyslexic atheist who spent lots of time laying awake at night wondering if there was a dog.
In so many ways, both with the humor, with the deep thought, with the theology, with the activism, Chuck, you have been part of the background that has made my life rich. I want to thank you for that. I want to thank you for being faithful to pursuing truth, even when it's hard. To do this with this unending call that leads you both into yourself and out of yourself. And thanks for joining me today for Spirit in Action.
Thanks for inviting me. Had a good time.
And Emma, thank you for exploring your soulmate here, Chuck, and writing about him. I know that with the masses of things he's written, as documented by the nearly 60 pages of bibliography, you had to enlarge your writing. Thank you for your service to Haverford College and the other people, the people you've welcomed to your rooms to create a wider world. And thanks for joining me for Spirit in Action.
Thanks for having me. This was an interesting way to spend a morning.
And folks, I've got links for Chuck. It'll be afriendlyletter.com, links on NordenSpiritRadio.org. We'll have a link to the book, Tell It Slant, Chuck Fager, A Prophetic Life of Adventure and Writing on Religion, War, and Justice, Love, and Laughter. We'll also have a link to connect you with Emma Lapsansky-Warner. We've got all of that on Norden Spirit Radio. Join us there, comment, and please join us next week for Spirit in Action. The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. Guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find deep roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will hope.